Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic family raising five kids outside of Boston, sharing the joys and challenges of marriage, school, our adventures near and far, and trying to make sense of this world we're living in while experiencing the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So at some point, I'm going to make you read some of that.
Why?
It's a collaborative podcast. I'm not like the host. We're together doing it.
Oh. Okay.
An introvert goes, I'm not doing this podcast anymore. So what's been happening? We had our last week was Independence Day, and that we talked about that. But this week I want to actually go back because I forgot about something that we had that was a big family thing that you got to miss out on. And I say that sarcastically. It was my sister-in-law's birthday. She had a milestone birthday, and I think it's public enough. I can say it's her 70th birthday. And my brother threw.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on that, but okay.
She doesn't listen. So my brother threw a surprise party for her, which I'm on record, and I think you're also on record as saying we don't like surprise parties.
Please never ever throw me a surprise party.
And this isn't just one of those. I'm saying it, but I won't mind if you actually do it. No. This is really, I will really don't. Actually be mad if you ever throw a surprise. Well, and I also hate throwing surprise parties throwing a party is hard enough, but managing the whole surprise part.
Why do you make things that much harder on yourself? I don't get it.
Oh, I don't like it. Anyway, so part of the problem is we had to keep it secret from my mom and my dad because my brother was afraid that they might slip and let it.
They would blurt.
Blow it. And so but I had to be the one to take my dad out. My dad lives with my brother and his wife. And so I had to take my dad out and then bring him to the party. And my brother tells him that I'm taking him out for dinner. I never take my dad out for dinner. My dad comes here for dinner. He comes over or our whole family goes, like you and the kids and I would go with him, but not just me and him. And so like my dad is all like, oh, is he going to ask me for money? Like, I would never ask my dad for money. No. My dad doesn't have any money. And so he lives with my brother.
It was quite perplexing.
It was he was perplexed. Dad. And I was like, what do I tell him? And he actually tried to get out of the dinner by saying he was going up to visit my sister in Maine. But that, which wasn't going to happen because she was coming down for the party.
But he didn't know about the party.
Right. So it was very amusing. And then I got him in the car. I'm like, Dad, OK, here's the deal. We're going to a surprise party for Carol.
I never actually heard. What did he say at that point?
He was confused. My dad is 86, so he can be confused easily, but he kind of got it. He's like, oh, well, why did he just tell me? And I'm like, I don't know. You have to ask Bernie. Like, I was just like, I don't know. Like, I didn't want to have to get, I didn't want to get in it between
so
him
you,
and Bernie.
You threw Bernie under the bus. Basically.
Yeah, well, he threw me under the bus.
Yeah. Turnaround's fair play.
I mean, Bernie got mad at me because I said in a text message, I really don't like lying to mom and dad. And I was just saying it out of frustration, the whole situation. And Bernie got mad, like, don't you ruin this for me. And I'm like, I'm not going to ruin it. I'm not a jerk. I'm, of course. Anyway, I mean, everything went fine. We got to the restaurant. Everybody was there. Unfortunately, you weren't there. Because it was a mostly adults only, except for Carol's grandkids and my nieces and nephews and my nephew's girlfriend.
In any case, our usual babysitters were all at the party.
Yeah. So Melanie had to stay with the kids, which I think that wasn't you like to see everybody. But as the introvert,
I'm slightly sad to have missed seeing Carol's party, but honestly, I can usually miss out on parties without being heartbroken. I mean,
yes.
Not because I don't love Carol and the family, but just
as an introvert,
a quiet evening at home is never really something I'm going to regret having.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially since I'm also out and not, you know, prone to come into the room and interrupt whatever you're doing to jabber at you.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
I know you. I know.
I don't remember what I did, honestly. I think I might have watched something.
Yeah.
I have no
idea. Whatever it was, you probably wrote a poem.
Probably.
You've been doing a lot of that.
Anyway, yeah.
So we can talk about that another time. So it was a good party. We had it at this place that Bernie loves because he says they have the best steak tips anywhere. Frankly, I think my steak tips are just as good. But they had scallops wrapped in bacon and stuffed mushrooms and all the sorts of things that my brother likes. So it was good.
Like typical party food. Yeah.
So Carol was born in Ireland. She was born in Belfast, came here as a young adult. And when she was first here, she lived in California as a nanny for this family and these two little girls that she was nanny for, like one of them from the time she was born until she was 20. She was like, nanny might be the wrong term. Like she was like Alice from Brady Bunch. She was like sort of
housekeeper, cook, nanny,
yeah,
all in one.
Governess. I don't know. She was Irish, so a governess kind of fits.
Au pair, yeah, maybe?
Sure. She wasn't.
They probably didn't call them au pairs back then, but that's like the
50 years ago, they didn't have au pairs.
Name for it. 50 years ago.
Or something like that. Yeah.
Well,
it was probably less than 50, but still, yeah.
She was probably like about 20.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But in any case, so they grew up and they flew out for this. They came out from California for this, which was really cool. It was really nice. And of course, my dad, being my dad, was the hit. Everyone loves my dad.
Yeah.
He's classic old Italian guy. Gets away with everything. I'm looking forward to that someday.
And he's a great storyteller, too.
He does. Yes. We'll have to have him on sometime. Wouldn't that be fun?
Oh, that would be really cool.
Yeah.
Nanu stories.
Nanu stories. I actually have a category in my journal of Nanu stories. So there was a good party. It was fun and saw some relatives that I hadn't seen, my aunt, Auntie Josie and others. And so it was nice. So speaking of birthday parties, so that was a few weeks ago. That was like before 4th of July. But this week we had Benedict's birthday.
Yeah. Our baby boy is 10.
Double digits. Yeah. So 10 years ago, our little Billy Rubin baby, jaundiced, our little jaundiced baby we brought home from the hospital and had to bring back.
Yeah, we got home. We had one day at home, and then the next day he was doing badly. So we had to go back to the hospital and spend a couple more days with him under the Billy lights.
Yes.
And
Billy lights. I think they were like goats or something.
I did not love that experience, but
yeah,
but you know, he's been fine.
And he's growing up so fast. I mean, they all are, but he's matured so much in the past just year, even.
Yeah.
He's just 10 starting to blossom.
10 is a really sweet age, I have to say.
10-year-old boys can be very sweet.
Helpful, yeah. Mature enough to actually be able to do stuff. He's very thoughtful and very kind.
Yes. So our tradition is that on a birthday, the child gets to pick a restaurant that the family will go to for dinner. I don't know how long we're going to continue doing this tradition.
As fewer of them can actually order from the kids menu, it might be like child goes with mom or dad to a restaurant.
Or mom and dad, and one of them stays home and babysits.
Yeah, that might be bad.
I'm all for that. Because when I was a kid, that's what we did. And like, we got to pick a place, and Evie being the kind, my younger sister Evie being the kind child she was, knew frugal my dad is. she picked McDonald's.
McDonald's.
Yes.
Yeah, I would never be quite that thoughtful.
I did things like, I've never been to a French restaurant. We're going to a French restaurant.
That would be me too.
Yes, we went. And I almost got my sister to order the Grenouille, which is frog legs.
I've had those.
Yes. I don't. Well, you're from the South. I mean, it's frog.
No, I mean, it was at a fancy like French restaurant.
So they're like fancy French frog legs.
That was when I worked for the psychologists, and they did like fancy Christmas brunches and things.
Oh, right. Right. They took you guys out. Well, and another time we went to this place here. So in Boston, and it was called the Colorado Public Library. I don't know why.
Colorado Public Library.
Yeah. In Boston. I don't know why. Anyway, but the whole place was like bookshelves and was lined with books everywhere.
Colorado.
Like I said, I don't know why. It just was. But one of the best parts about it, I still remember. And I was like 10 or 11 around that time. They had a flaming dessert. What that they made at the table side? Like
flambé, something or other.
Something like, yeah. Or the
Baked Alaska.
Or the banana thing.
Banana.
This Foster.
Yeah.
Something like that. It was, or flaming brandies or something. Hey, there was fire that they were making at the table side.
Well, of course you couldn't pass that up.
Of course. Well, I mean, I didn't actually get to have it.
Anyway,
I think it was alcoholic. So
Ben did not get any flaming.
Ben didn't do any of that. That blessed child, speaking of cheap dads, he picked Bertucci's, which is a sort of local, it's mostly Boston area Italian chain, although I gather they have outposts all the way down to Virginia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like scattered, like here and there. But we went, it's, you know, it's got a brick oven, they have pizza, they have stuff like that. Turns out, on Tuesdays, kids eat free. Like, and not just, you have to have one adult per kid, like all the kids.
We did not know that until we got the bill either.
Oh, yeah. I mean, awesome. The waitress saw us coming. Bella is older now. She orders from the adult menu, but we got four free kids meals, which are like $5, but $6. I saved like over $30, which is sweet. We'd save like a third of the price of the meal.
Yeah.
Although, pro tip, when you get a discount on your meal, like a coupon or some sort of deal like that, you tip on what it would have been, not on what with the.
If you want your waitress to not.
Well, if you want to be a good person. Yeah.
Well, but it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I've known and have been family with a lot of people who've lived on tips, and so just do that. So that was good.
So basically, we got up. He opened his presents.
That's our other tradition.
Yeah,
we open presents in the morning.
Since Dominic,
I work from home.
Works from home, so we can do that, and then they get all day to play with the toys, which is pretty sweet. I
kind of brilliant, I think.
Yeah. So no schoolwork, of course. They built Lego sets all day long.
Puzzle.
And read his new book.
His jigsaw puzzle.
New Asterix book.
Yeah, new Asterix book. Oh yeah, that one is always a big hit.
And then after we. Our dinner at Bertucci's, we came home and had cake, of course.
Of course. A cake that we'll talk about in a minute in our food section. So a nice birthday. And then 2 days later, we have his feast day, which is the Feast of St. Benedict, and which was it's not coincidental that it's 2 days later that we kind of picked his name partly based on.
No.
I thought we probably picked it.
No, we just picked it because we liked the name. It was just kind of cool. I was really gunning for him to be born on his feast day, but he was my first scheduled C-section.
Right.
And the year he was born, his feast day fell on a Saturday, and there was just no way I could talk the OB into doing surgery on Saturday. Right. So he was born on a Thursday, and then 2 days later, we had his feast day.
That's right. Yeah. We just picked the wrong year to have him.
Right.
Well, it's also named for Pope Benedict, because that Pope Benedict was Pope at the time, and because your dad's name...
My dad's middle name is Benedict.
Benedict, yes.
So it's a family... And actually, one of my dad... I did not know this at the time we picked his name, but one of my dad's uncles actually is Benedict Joseph.
Really? Which one?
My dad's Uncle Ben.
Oh, his uncle.
My dad's
not your uncle. Yeah. Okay.
And I mean, I knew that my dad had an Uncle Ben, but I had just always assumed, because Benjamin is the most common Ben, that he was Uncle Benjamin. But I saw a picture on the family Facebook page of his tombstone, and it said Benedict J. Scott. And then I asked, because I just kind of had to know, well, J is also our Ben's middle initial, so what is it? And it turned out his name was Benedict Joseph, which was really cool. So he was named after Uncle Ben, who is one of my dad's favorite uncles. So
sort of named after.
I mean, yeah, but.
But he shares the name with.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's kind of
cool. That is cool. Was he good at rice, Uncle Ben?
I don't think so.
So and then what's the other bit of news this week? The big stuff that's been going on is we've had to boil water for the past couple of days.
Yeah, that's been fun.
Our small town shares a water pumping station with the next town over, and they've been having troubles. They had a pump break like 3-4 weeks ago. And it's not something you run down to Home Depot and get a new pump. It has to be custom built in the factory and shipped out. And then something went wrong when they were installing it, or something, pressure dropped. And then they were afraid that bacteria could get into the system. And out of an abundance of caution, they told everyone that you have to boil water, and you can't wash your hands with it. You can't wash your dishes with the tap water. You could shower with it as long as you didn't drink it while the water is you showering. Who does that? That's gross. I'm sorry, but don't do that.
I think some people like brush their teeth in the shower and stuff.
Yeah, that's that is absolutely normal for some people. I'm just going to say that. but like taking medicine was a hassle. Oh, such a pain. And I suspected that it would be fine. And so they have to like wait till the pressure comes back up, and then they have to test the water twice, 6 hours apart, and then sent it to the state lab, which takes time. And then it was only like, so that was 2 days, basically. Was it 2 days?
Yesterday
morning?
Three, I don't know.
Something like that, whatever it was. And by the end of the day today, it was back. But, and now the water is all white. And it's so funny watching our town's Facebook page, like our Facebook group, people talking about it. The water is all white, like it's milky white. It's full of bacteria. It's like, that's air bubbles. It's this air in the system.
Bacteria don't turn water white.
Yeah, exactly. Bacteria turns it black or green or some other unsavory color, or you don't see it
or
at all.
No color. Like the scary, dangerous ones are dangerous because you don't see them. It looks like normal. It tastes. Right. It looks like.
This is why you don't drink from fresh mountain streams without treating it first.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, that was the other thing. So we had all this water that we had to boil and had pots of boiled water sitting around.
I suppose it was a little bit of a, you know, science lesson or something.
Or something. I think the kids got a little more worried than I was. I was, you know, I brushed my teeth with tap water. I was thinking they didn't issue the boil order until like 8 hours after everything happened. So like we were drinking and brushing teeth with and washing dishes with what could have been contaminated water already. So, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, at least for me. I mean, if I was elderly or had a chronic illness or had a baby, that might be different, but
I used bottled water.
I wasn't worried about
brushing.
I wasn't,
but I wasn't hyper about like washing my hands with bottled water because I don't have time for that. I wash my hands a million times a day, especially when I'm cooking dinner.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah. but nobody got sick. So I guess we're safe
so far. So that leads us to talking about, as usual, what we've been eating. And frankly, we haven't, apart from going out to dinner, we haven't really had anything remarkable. I made those really thick pork chops the other day that were marinated on the grill. And we made some grilled chicken. We had some quesadillas. We had quesadillas made of the pulled pork we made last week. We talked about that. So nothing really exciting. We had chicken stir fry time with leftover chicken. But you've made a birthday cake. And this was cake that Lucy could eat or couldn't eat?
Actually, this one was not Lucy friendly.
Okay.
So Lucy has a lot of food allergies.
Yep.
She's allergic to wheat, dairy, eggs, corn, nuts.
Corn, folks. Corn isn't everything.
So I've learned how to do allergy friendly baking. Which basically I look up gluten-free recipes and I follow them because that's pretty much. And then I substitute like
the dairy.
She can eat dairy that's been baked.
Right.
As long as it's baked and it's not like a predominant ingredient.
The allergist has confirmed this. Yes.
Yeah, we did a food challenge and everything. So she can eat baked dairy and eggs, which is nice. So I don't have to use like baked eggs in baking. But she can't have like scrambled eggs or things that have too much egg in them. So I've learned how, like, but I've found that I really like cooking with some of the ingredients that I use for her baking. Like almond flour is the best thing ever.
Well, something we've discovered is in Spain, there was a huge tradition of making desserts with almond flour. Who knew? Plus almond, it's protein.
Right.
It's awesome.
So my custom is to make Lucy muffins that we keep in the freezer. For one thing, the allergist said it will help to desensitize her to the eggs and the dairy if she eats them baked in things. And so she's supposed to eat baked eggs and dairy daily. And also because of her limited diet, she can't have any dairy food. So, of course, like cereal and milk is out and, you know, she can't have eggs for breakfast. So her default breakfast is a muffin and I keep them in the freezer so they don't go bad. But because they're made with, you know, almond flour and eggs and milk, they're really protein heavy, so they're not bad for breakfasts. So anyway, for Ben's birthday cake, I made him a devil's food cake that was 50% regular wheat flour, cake flour, and 50% almond flour. It was really rich and really good. And I made a cream cheese frosting, which is my favorite kind of frosting.
Now, the cake kind of, you made it in a bundt pan.
Yeah.
And the cake kind of fell a little bit.
Yeah, almond flour has a tendency to be a little bit more finicky. So sometimes it kind of puffs up and then falls. And then because Lucy doesn't like to be left out, she got Well, I had made her chocolate muffins, which is essentially the same thing as chocolate cupcakes, really. And that's what she's been eating this week anyway. So for her birthday treat, I made her some coconut cream frosting and she put it on her chocolate muffins. Mm-hmm. And she was happy as a clam because the frosting was really good.
Almond flour doesn't have gluten, right? So,
right.
So that's probably why it fell. I'm just trying to think. I'm doing this.
Yeah, you're reducing the amount of gluten.
So there's not enough structure. So it's nothing to hold up. So you got to figure out a way to.
I probably should have added an extra egg just to add more structure.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. See, that's the fun thing about it is you can't just follow the box or look in the Betty Crocker. You got to figure it out. You got to try and make multiple cakes.
A lot of my baking is trial and error. And I really almost don't make the same recipe twice. I do a lot of what all the cookbooks and all the recipe sites tell you not to do, which is I wing it.
For baking.
I mean, a lot of the people, well, you can wing it for, you know, sauces and things, but you're not supposed to wing it for baking.
Baking is science, and so you're supposed to be precise.
I am not precise when I bake at all, and which means I end up with my share of flat, hard, fallen desserts. But it's experimental, and I'm getting a really good sense of an intuitive sense of how to use the various ingredients, and it's fun.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of neat to have all these different kinds of flours and things that we've had to figure out. And, you know, so instead of cornstarch, we have to use either arrowroot or potato starch or tapioca starch or different kinds of starches that depending on what you're cooking. So in that sense, I mean, it's kind of fun. It does limit us a little bit in what we can make because, you know, I'm looking at recipes, you know, for what we should. Oh, it's corn is a prime ingredient. I guess we're not making that, you know, that.
Yeah. About 50% of our recipes that look good, we end up throwing out or because they would have to be modified so severely that they just. Right.
You can modify some things a little bit, but then it's at some point it doesn't become worth it. So one of the things I started doing is I subscribe to like Cooks Illustrated, Cooks Country, Milk Street Kitchen magazines. And I also, you know, follow a bunch of different cooking websites. And I've started like on Sunday afternoons in the nice weather, I'll sit on the porch after, you know, after I've made pancakes, Sunday pancakes and a chance to sit down. I'll sit out there with them and I'll go through them looking for recipes I want to try. And it just goes into, so I use Paprika Recipe Manager, which is the software I use for keeping track of recipes, and it goes into a category of to try so that when we're thinking of menus of, you know, what are we going to make this week? I often go through that. And so I've made some fun things. I've made some Russian things. Mm-hmm. I made zarkoya, which was the Russian beef stew, which is good. That was good.
Yeah, it was okay.
The cabbage rolls were okay. I should have just made a smaller portion.
Yeah.
There were way too many cabbage rolls. And, so it was so it's a lot of I really enjoy doing that, going through the and finding recipes from that are unusual, not just the same old Italian, Chinese and, you know, that sort of thing, like, ooh, an Armenian recipe. Ooh, Turkish. Ooh. So, and, you know, Senegalese, you know, it's fun to try these different things.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Melanie's not as always interested.
Sometimes, yeah, I'm like skeptical, but it makes my job with meal planning easier because when you find a recipe that you want to try, that means you cook dinner.
Right. That means I'm cooking, which, you know, I'm happy to do again because I work from home. That gives me the ability to, I'm not getting home at 6 o'clock and then tired from an awful commute like I used to do.
I really hated it when you didn't come home until
like sometimes 6:30,
seven
even. Yeah. I hated those days too because I'd be leaving the house at 6:30 in the morning often. But now, you know, I finish work. I can even like if I can get things done early around 4:30, I get the grill started and, you know, get cooking. And I like that. So so that's what's up with that. So let's talk a little bit about what's been entertaining us. I finished that third season of Stranger Things. No spoilers. But oh, my gosh, I was so mad at first. I may not be as mad now, but you know, when you watch it, you know, maybe drop me an email and maybe we'll do an episode of Secrets of Movies and TV Shows, one of our other podcasts on Stranger Things season 3, because I really feel like I need to talk about it with somebody.
I understand that feeling.
Yeah, but so to finish that, I watched finally on Netflix, I think it was the Spider-Man animated movie Into the Spider-Verse. People were raving about that. And now
I've seen a lot of people saying that they loved it.
And now I understand why. It was really good.
Maybe I should check it out.
Yeah. Well, I think it was really good, not only because the writing and the acting were good, but because the animation really respects the original material. It feels comic booky without feeling gimmicky.
Interesting.
It feels like it's of a piece of the original medium. And because it pulls in characters from different Spider-Man comic book series, it respects those styles of those comic books, like Spider-Pig, even.
Spider-Pig,
yes, yes. Just trust me on it. It's fine. It's okay.
Okay.
Like the noir Spider-Man, who was voiced by National Treasure, Raising Arizona.
Nicolas Cage.
I wanted to say Nick Nolte for some reason. Nicolas Cage voices it. And he does a good job with it. So that was good. And then what I'm reading right now is a Star Wars novel called Alphabet Squadron. And it takes place after the fall of the Empire. So after Endor, in the immediate aftermath. And it deals with the question of what did the New Republic do with all the Imperial soldiers and pilots and et cetera, who saw the writing on the wall and wanted to defect.
Interesting.
What do you trust them? Are they trustworthy? Very interesting. And what do you do about those who don't defect until later? Do you trust them less because they waited? It's an interesting, and it has some analogs in our time. With Nazis,
right. I was thinking the same thing.
At the end of World War II, when they wanted to come over afterward, you're just quitting because you're losing, or because it's a moral thing. So it's an interesting book in that. It has some flaws. It's not great, but it's an interesting book so far. Mm-hmm. So now,
did I talk about Reamed on our last podcast?
Yes, we talked about Reamed. So I finished Neil Stevenson.
I finished that, and I had a very fun conversation with my friend Aaron Arlinghouse about that, who was really excited that I'd finally read it. And
I'm going to read it next.
Yeah. So that was fun. Other than that, I'm still finishing up Brideshead Revisited this week. And
that's what you have to know about Melanie in reading is she reads a lot, but she reads a bunch of books at once. So it takes time.
And I honestly don't know that I remember reading anything else this week. I must have.
Yeah. Well. So other things that have we talked about the Daily Poem podcast?
I don't know if we have.
So let's talk
about
that.
That's one of my favorites.
So, yeah. So you listen to this podcast, the Daily Poem podcast. Tell me about it.
OK, so it's put out by Circe, which is
Christian.
Yeah, they're sort of Christian, classical homeschooling. I don't know what noun to put there with all those adjectives.
Cooperative, I think, resource.
I think they sell curriculum, maybe, but they certainly they have like podcasts and a website, and I think maybe a magazine. I don't know. I'm just starting to dip my toes in the water, but they have they started off with a podcast called Close Reads, and they read books and they do like a very slow read through. So they'll do a podcast episode for one or two chapters of a book. And so they'll cover a book over a series of weeks, which is really nice. In fact, I listened to their Brideshead Revisited. I'm listening to their Brideshead Revisited podcast. And so as a sort of spinoff of that, they started the Daily Poem. And it's really is daily. That's one, they only weekdays, but they read one poem every week. And it started off the first few episodes, the first couple months, he just read the poem and then maybe read the poem again if it was a short poem. But then as he sort of got more comfortable, the host is David Kern. He started like sort of he'd read the poem and then he'd say a few things about it. You know, he'd introduce the poet, like tell you about their life, about the circumstances of the poem. But then maybe, you know, read a little bit of commentary or just comment on some of the things that struck him in the poem. I liked this image or I liked. And sometimes he talks about poetics, like look at the rhyme scheme or notice the enjambment here or, you know, various poetic devices. And so it's a nice little lesson in poetics. The kids don't always listen. I mean, sometimes they're off doing their own thing, but sometimes they listen in and sometimes they comment on the poems or even say something about the poem a couple days later. that shows that they were really paying attention. And then sometimes they'll hear like a name, like today, one of the poems I was listening to was a speech from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. And when he said Shakespeare, I noticed that the kids who were playing in the other room came running because they wanted to hear what Shakespeare he was reading.
Oh, very cool. Fun.
And they were excited because it was from Merchant of Venice, which we actually saw a couple years ago.
It play in the park.
Yeah, Shakespeare in the Park by a local community theater troupe. And so, yeah, the Daily Poem podcast, I highly recommend. They're short episodes. None of them are longer than 10 minutes, I think. Yeah. And so you can just like listen in, tune in, get a little bit of poem. They do a great range of poets. From classic, you know, British poets, American poets, old poets, new poets, poets who are, you know, writing right now, and poets who wrote hundreds of years ago.
The whole variety.
It's introduced me to some poets I didn't know. And I think I know quite a bit about poetry, having a degree in literature that focused on poetry. But I've met some fun new poets through this podcast.
Cool. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes on sqpn.com/bets. So the other thing I noticed that has kind of been animating you this week is sort of a throwback, a little bit of nostalgia to the way the old time blogging blogosphere, the Catholic blogosphere, where a friend of ours, Simca Fisher, wrote a blog post about the novels of E.B. White. And she was writing about some things in it. Some things she found disturbing. And then you wrote a response and some other friends wrote a response and it went from there.
Yeah. When I first started blogging more than 10 years ago now, I was a little bit trepidatious stepping into the waters. And when the first people who I didn't actually personally know started commenting on my blog, I got a little bit freaked out, actually. But over time, I came to really enjoy the conversations and the way that in the old days before Facebook and Twitter,
when Google Reader still roamed the land,
right? One blogger would write something and then another blogger would write a blog post that responded and somebody else would write something that responded to that and everybody would link to each other's posts and you'd have this conversation going on. And I kind of missed that days of blogging. So Simca wrote about E.B. White, Charlotte's Web and Trumpet of the Swan and Stuart Little and some things that made her uncomfortable as a reader, that felt sort of depressing and nihilistic to her and troublesome. And then my friend Darwin of Darwin Catholic wrote a defense of E.B. White, so saying he really liked the way that E.B. White's anthropomorphic animals work. That was the question is, E.B. White writes novels which are very realistic, so they don't feel like fairy tales or fables or fantasy novels. They exist very much in our world and yet have talking animals. And some of the moral dilemmas that exist are sort of straddling this line. Are animals who can speak, you know, are they sentient? Are they, you know, do they have a moral weight to them as the people do?
Is it moral that we that human beings eat
talking pigs?
Talking pigs,
right? I mean,
this comes up actually in a lot of the kids' media now. I mean, Madagascar, the cartoon, has these animals in the zoo who have lives of their own and
right
sentience.
So it's an interesting question. This idea of what do we do with anthropomorphic animals? And I think that some readers or viewers, we're talking about movies, are more comfortable with anthropomorphic animals than others.
Melanie does not like stories where animals talk.
I'm really not a fan. And so Simca's post resonated with me precisely because I've always been a little uncomfortable with talking animals. I mean, I know that when I read a fairy tale, I can enter into it. Don't refuse to read them or watch them. But at the same time, even when I was a kid, my mind would kind of churn like, how exactly does that work? Like the mice that Cinderella talks to, like, do all mice in her world talk or just these particular ones? And why do they talk? Well, and
welcome to my life, people.
Right.
This is you're overthinking it.
Right. And in fact, in several of the Facebook conversations I was taking part in, a lot of people said, man, this Simca Fisher woman, she's like really overthinking and overanalyzing this. It's just a children's book. But I'm actually, you know, my training is as a literary scholar, and this is precisely up my alley. And I love thinking about the ways that people read, and especially the ways that certain like moments of friction when a book or story or poem or anything work of art bothers us, that we can either like dismiss it and push it away and say it's wrong or it's bad, or we can sort of lean in and say, well, what does that tell me about myself as a reader? Or what does that tell me about the world or the work of literature? Like sometimes those moments of friction are the most interesting things, and they lead to the most interesting conversations. In a classroom, those are often the really good conversations where you really feel like everyone leaves the conversation thinking, I know more about the world and myself and human nature or whatever than I did before I had this conversation.
You know, that reminded me of a children's book that I really, it makes me uncomfortable and has that friction. It's Maurice Sendak's In the Night Kitchen.
Oh, yeah. When I took a children's literature class in college, and my teacher hated that book, hated.
Yes.
With a passion. She did not really like Maurice Sendak in general, but especially the In the Night Kitchen book really bothered her.
Right. It's there's something about
it. It's creepy.
It. Yeah.
It's a creepy book.
Well, When I was little, the book that really creeped me out was Seuss, The Cat in the Hat.
Yeah, I think that bothers a lot of people. I mean, he's very transgressive.
Well, not just the cat, but also thing one and thing two and thing three. Is there thing three?
No, just one and two.
Well, thing one and thing two. And just the way that they treat the kids.
They break the rules.
Yes.
They're
very disturbing.
They're very pushy. And I think that that's what delights some readers. Some people like that transgressiveness and the fact that it sort of contains the transgressiveness, and it allows you to examine it, put it under a glass. And that's one of the great things about literature, is it lets us examine these moments of tension and these problems in a way that's safe, because we're not having to actually deal with people coming into our own house and deal with. And yet there are moments where we have had to deal sometimes with people who are too transgressive, people who make us uncomfortable and push on our boundaries. And so one of the things that literature does is it lets us talk about that with kids in a way that doesn't leave us gossiping about our friends and family or neighbors, because we're only talking about characters in a book. And
Yeah, another book that's like that.
Uh-huh.
Charlie and the Chocolate
Factory. Oh, yeah.
Roald Dahl is another author like that.
Roald Dahl is actually an author I have decided, I know a lot of my friends, even some of my very, very close friends, love Roald Dahl. He makes me very uncomfortable. And while I won't ban my kids from picking up a Roald Dahl book in the library, I have opted not to read any Roald Dahl books aloud to them, because I find it creepy. And maybe partly my creep factor is the fact that at one point when I was a teenager, I got my hands on a book of his short stories that were not written for kids. They were written for adults. And there was some really creepy, weird, disturbing, weird stuff.
Roald Dahl was a creepy dude. So I don't know actually if I've ever read the book, but I like the films, the Wilder film, Gene Wilder.
Yeah.
That version.
That was,
to me, that's the definitive version. And I liked it, except for a couple of the bits of it. The kids who have these horrible fates, the ones who transgress, and that weird tunnel of love, scary thing.
Yeah,
they do.
It's creepy. There are moments of truly,
and yet there's moments of great wonder and amazement.
Yeah,
in it. That's the friction you're talking about.
Right.
Like that, if you push through that friction, I think the joy that you get from the parts that resonate with you might be even more.
Right. And in fact, so I sat down and I wrote my blog post about it. And one of the things I talk about is the feeling of sort of being able to straddle the line and to recognize that one part of me, you know, can enter into the fiction and with this sort of childlike delight and really like it. I read Charlotte's Web to the kids and I enjoyed reading it to them. White is a great writer. His use of English is really beautiful. And there are a lot of elements of the story that are very charming and engaging, and I like it. And yet, on the other hand, if I close my other eye, I can see that there are things about it that are really disturbing and creepy. We've got a talking pig, and they're going to eat him. And that's really troublesome.
That'll do, pig. That'll do.
Right. And so I think children's literature allows us to explore this. Darwin Catholic made a great point. He said that, you know, in fact, kids often have the experience of they really, really love their pet, be it dog or cat or even a pet pig, and they really don't like some people that they know. And yet we treat animals and people very differently. And we, you know, animals are animals and we eat them. Sometimes they have to be put to sleep. If your dog gets sick, you might need to put it to sleep. You don't put grandma to sleep if she gets sick, right?
Not yet, anyway.
Right. Oh, well, unfortunately, we live in a world where these things are becoming more and more blurry. Well, and maybe,
in fact, we're doing the opposite, where animals are treated like people and people are treated like animals.
And in fact, it's perhaps that context of a world in which those boundaries are no longer so clear that makes E.B. White's novels feel more creepy and problematic than they did at the time he wrote them, when euthanasia was not a serious problem, that social problem that we were grappling with. Like, you know, here in Massachusetts, at least, it's an issue that we're fighting in the state house right now.
Right.
As we speak. And so it's no longer purely in the realm of children's stories. This is in the realm of it could happen to you.
Right.
And therefore, it takes on an urgency, maybe, and a gravity that it didn't have at the time he wrote. I mean, he was a farmer. He actually raised pigs and ate them. And so for him, I think that maybe talking pigs doesn't have the same, I don't know. But I think that it kind of does. Like, the book is clearly meant to grapple with some of those questions. Fern gets very upset about killing Wilbur.
Right. You know, interesting with our own kids, like, we don't raise animals, we don't have pets, but we have dealt with eating animals that we just saw live with lobsters. Like, from when they're little, we've bought live lobster and cooked them and let them handle them. And even, you know, hey, lobster, and then in the pot and yum, yum later on.
Right. Like, Bella as a toddler loved to get down on the floor with the lobsters and like she really adored them.
Oh, my gosh. She was so cute with them.
And then she really adored eating them, too.
Yes, because she's her father's daughter.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit interesting, like nostalgia, throwback to the old days of blogging that we've been trying to recapture a little bit, because social media has become what it is. And it was nice when we could have these interesting conversations among our blogs, but also an interesting conversation in and of itself.
Right.
So it's pretty cool. The last thing I wanted to talk about was something actually that's happened this very day as we're recording this. Also about social media. I got labeled as a hate speech person. I had one of my posts removed for hate speech by Facebook. And this is what I posted. It's a quotation. It says, "Let us never assume that if we live good lives, we will be without sin. Our lives should be praised only when we continue to beg for pardon. But men are hopeless creatures, and the less they concentrate on their own sins, the more interested they become in the sins of others. They seek to criticize, not to correct. Unable to excuse themselves, they are ready to accuse others." By St. Augustine. And that was removed.
I have a very hard time seeing what is hate speech or problematic
at all. It's the opposite of hate speech. It calls people to not use hate speech, to not.
Right. Don't judge other people's sins. Focus on your own.
And this isn't just like someone rogue reporting it, because this originally was posted by a priest friend of mine, and he had it taken down. And then another priest friend of in common, he posted it. That went down. And then I posted it. That went down. And I told all my friends about it. And they've all been posting it. And theirs have been going down. And so this isn't like one really energetic person going from post to post reporting it, because for some reason they have a grudge against Augustine.
Saint Augustine.
I mean, the Venn diagram of friends in common is vanishingly small, and probably just me of all the people posting it. I can only imagine it's got to be some automated algorithm, automated system that's finding something. The guess that we've come up with is the line, men are hopeless creatures, which is so anodyne, so blah, blah. Like, I mean, I've heard women say, my husband is hopeless. I mean, that's basically
But I think maybe the particularity of one particular man versus making generalized statements about men and women, maybe that's what it's flagging like.
Perhaps in the same sentence with sin. Being used in this, or in the same paragraph, being used with the word sin and criticize or correct. I don't know. I mean, it's just so weird.
Kind of curious, because if it is like an algorithm, I really want to see the algorithm. Like, what have they got it set up to flag?
Well, it's by now at least 20 other people have posted it on theirs. I've reported as each time it comes up, there's a thing to say, hey, ask to have this reviewed by a human being to see if it really does violate community standards. So I've requested it. So hopefully some human being is going to look at it and go, I don't know why we're blocking this. Or at least someone can give me a reason why it's not acceptable. But this is St. Augustine.
You'd kind of hope that they would actually agree that it doesn't violate community standards. Like, but in this day and age, I
want to know what community standards it's violating. Because I want to know what am I supposed to not be saying here?
Unfortunately, in my experience with having things removed by social media,
they never tell you.
They don't tell you exactly what it is that you've done. So you're left kind of scratching your head and wondering.
This is the worst kind of correction. Like, when you're a parent and you correct a child, you don't just punish them and not tell them why they're being punished, right? You know, you explain so that you're correcting a behavior. If you just remove it without explaining why it's being removed, you're not actually correcting anything. You're not telling them, well, here's how you can not fall into this trap again, how you can avoid having this problem again. You're just, it's gaslighting. You're essentially gaslighting people.
Right.
So,
yeah, I had a similar experience some time ago. With Amazon, they removed one of my reviews of a book, and all they could say is that it seemed like more than one person at an address was, or something like that, like was reviewing it.
Right. But except I hadn't reviewed it, I'm the only other person who lives here who would review it.
All we could think of is that my sister and I both reviewed the book, and she used to live here, but hasn't in
8, 10 years.
6 years.
Six years. Yeah, no, it was Lucy. Yeah.
Anyway, it's baffling when these things happen, like, out of the blue.
This is the sort of thing we talk about on Secrets of Technology, which I think I might bring up on an upcoming episode of that, because, gosh, it's partly turning into Secrets of Complaining about social media, but you know, these are real issues that we have to deal with. I mean, the president, whatever you think of him, had this summit at the White House talking about these sorts of problems. I mean, this is a big, when these private companies have become the town square, this is how we communicate with one another. Heck, the president of the United States communicates with the world through one of these private companies, which has been talking about enforcing certain rules on world leaders. I don't know if you've heard about that. They've been talking about that, like the way world leaders can use their service.
I hadn't heard about that.
I mean, this becomes an important issue for us as a society to think about how these services affect how we live together, how we communicate with one another. You know, it's so that's what's happened today for me. So it's very, very frustrating, especially given that it's a really topical quote from St. Augustine about, hey, we should be more concerned with the plank in our eye and not the splinter in our neighbor's eye, which is essentially what he's saying there. I wonder if I could put that quote from the Bible in there, see if that could get renewed. I mean, what was it? The Declaration of Independence got pulled down for violation.
Right.
Oh, something. I forget which line. I mean, when you read, you go, oh, yeah, that's why they did it, because it referred, uses an antiquated term for people, Native Americans, I think, or something like that.
I don't remember.
I forget what it was, but it used an antiquated term that today is unacceptable in regular speech. But back then, it's a historical document. All right, calm down. So I'll let you know how that goes as next week when we come back to this topic. So I think that's about all we had to talk about.
It's been a boring week.
Yeah, although we got 49 minutes out of it, so we can talk about it. I mean, I thought it was interesting. What do you think? Was that interesting? Let us know by visiting sqpn.com/bets, BETTS, or you could go to the SQPN Facebook page, which is facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, and you can leave feedback there. You can send us an email to bets@sqpn.com, BETTS. And you can find relevant links from our discussion, like links to Bill Melanie's blog post and Simka's blog post and the Daily Poem podcast, etc. You can find all that on our show notes at sqpn.com. So again, remember to like Raising the Bets and StarQuest on Facebook. I gave you the link before. And also on Twitter, where we're at sqpn, because I'm soon going to be banned from Facebook. So Twitter is going to be where I can go. And then until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.